Is it all good? Sorry. Okay, thanks. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation and talk about this. That's the abstract, we can skip that. So this is the Schrodinger equation as we saw before, but this time without a potential. So just free, easier. With the data in the homogeneous Sobolev space in L2. Now the solution can be written like that, which is the adjoint of the restriction operator to the paraboloid. So if you take the adjoint, so I'll often refer to restriction theorems, even though that's not much of a restricted operator, because it's the adjoint of a restricted operator. And that is the scaling relation which we saw before. So we'll see that number cropping up a lot. And the Strickhart's estimates, which we saw before, are these. Normally, this is an L2 theorem. So when equality holds here, you have L2 on this side. And so, so I've got the R's and Q's the wrong way around. They hold first of all, they were proven by, there was a theorem by Stein and Thomas previously, and then Strickhart proved at this exponent n over 2n plus 2, so when q is equal to r here on the line, so it was an L2 result. And then Ginebra and Velo mixed the norms, getting this line here, and then Tao and Q put that endpoint on, and you get everything inside here just by trivial considerations, Sobolev embedding and Littlewood-Paley and so on. So what I'm going to talk about is what happens when you change the order of the norms. So before we're integrating in space first, if you integrate first in time, then you can expect something different. So that's been proven. So what's this line is here. So it goes down now to the restriction exponent, and this point here is that number there. And so you get, just by Minkowski's integral inequality, for certain q's and r's, when q is greater than r, you can just immediately get the results from the Strickhart's exponents, the Strickhart's estimates. So you get all these for free from the Strickhart's exponent, the Strickhart's estimate. This also comes easily enough by Sobolev embedding. And, well, I'll just tell you what happens in one dimension. So you've got this estimate A. Is this too small? When n is equal to 1, that estimate A is due to, it was in the thesis of Vega and appeared in a appeared in an article of Vega, Kenny Ponce and Vega, where you get L2 in time And here you get minus a half derivative. So that was proven, and at this point here was proven, point B. As the supremum in time H 1/4. Now that was proven a sort of a local version of this, when local in time and local in space in L1 was proven by Carlson in connection with another problem, which I'll talk about in a second. And then that was improved by Koenig and Ruiz. And then that, to get global in space and time, is due to Stein. So, in one dimension is solved. Also, in higher dimensions, this bit here, down to this exponent, n plus so in this range here, this is proven by an argument due to Vargas, Tao and Vargas, combined with the bilinear restriction estimate of Tau. So there's only two regions left of interest, this one here and this one here, or open rather than. One thing we'll prove is these estimates up to endpoints for high dimensions. And the other point, so here's the diagram. So this S here, bizarrely, so we've seen here this S can be negative. That can't happen with the Strickhart's estimates, but if you change the order, it can be negative. So in this region, you're getting negative S's over here, so some kind of smoothing. And the proof will be based on the bilinear techniques pioneered by Bergan, Tao, Vargas, Vega, and Wolf. hold on. And this point here will prove conditionally. So there's a conjecture, a folk conjecture, if you like, about the pointwise convergence of the solution, and will prove that we'd get this region here if that were true. But I'll talk about that in a minute. So first of all, why are they different? Why are things different? Now there's an important thing called the Galilean invariance. When you integrate in space first, then time, this is perhaps not the Galilean invariance, but something along these lines. If you consider this is space, and again, we're evolving in time using the equation. If we start with some bump function, the data being a bump function supported there, if it has low frequency, it doesn't move fast. It might even just stay there. And so you end up with some kind of tube like that. Nothing much happens for the first while. Then things change a little bit. Now this is just to illustrate what's happening. But if you move the frequency far away, the wave goes it moves fast, so you end up with a tube which looks like that. So that's the difference if you change the frequency. But if you integrate in space first, you don't really see that, you know, that's a translation. Whereas, if you integrate in time first, you certainly do see it, you know, integrating that piece compared to integrating that piece is very different. So we also see from this that the Stuttgart testings can't hold when S is negative, because where's the Stuttgart testings? If this was negative, you could just move the frequency support far away. This would tend to zero, and this would be invariant. This wouldn't necessarily tend to zero. So that you can see that you can't get negative S for Stuttgart systems. All right, and that's not true when you change the order. Right, now, so now I'm going to go back to this problem here, just to motivate, essentially. This number one is equivalent to number one is equivalent to saying that the solution, the limit as time tends to zero of the solution, tends to the data for almost every x. Now you only need local in time and local in space, so that's the unit ball. You only need local things to get that result. But also, this global bound has been considered by Kenny Ponce and Vega to prove things about well-posedness of the KV equation and so on that comes up. And so there's many results about these. So one and two. Hold on. So this is, I'm talking here when Q is equal to 2 and R is equal to infinity. In that case, you have this equivalence. So we're talking about maximal operators. And what results? So I'm always, on this blackboard, I'm talking about this case, Q equal to 2, R equal to infinity. Known results are N equaling 1, Carlson, S greater than or equal to 1/4, or it. Carlson just, so that would be Carlson, Ruiz, and Koenig. And then S greater than 1/2 is proven by Vega. N equaling 2. S greater than 1/2 is Scholin and Vega independently. And that follows from the local smoothing, which is very important in the Schrodinger equation. And that was improved by many people, Bergan, Tao and Vargas. And the best result to date is 3/8 by Sanyuk Lee. And here the best result was 1 due to Cowling and Carberry, again independently. And higher dimensions the best result here is 1/2 and 1 again. And the conjectures are conjectures for N. They hope, I don't know if anyone ever conjectured any of these things, but S greater than 1/4 would be nice, and S greater than or equal to 1/2. The counter examples suggest that. Anyway, so there's an equivalence between these two, which I'm not going to talk about today because I spoke about in the conference in Georgia recently. But you get there's the scaling relation, and you get this 2 popping out. So when Q is equal to 2 and R is equal to infinity, that's 0. The scaling relation is 0 nicely. It makes calculations nice sometimes. And then so you get a double, and you see this double here. So you get 1/4, 1/2, 1, 1/2, 1, 1/4, 1/2, and we get a corollary here. So this is true when S is greater than 3/4. So I've already said that. That's the maximum operator. And also you see when Q and R are both equal to 2, a lot of you will know that you have a local smoothing phenomenon. You can take S equal to minus a half there. So if you plug in minus a half here, so minus a half on this side, minus a half on this side, you get minus 1 there. This is 0, and that is 1 now. So you get 0 on this side, and of course when you look here, if you take 2 there, and 0 here, you see that's that follows by the conservation of charge. You know, that's an L2 on this side, L2 on that side, you integrate locally. So that's another equivalent. Anyway, what we're also going to see, what I'm going to talk about today, is that, so we've seen an equivalence between the local-local conjecture and the local-global conjecture, and we'll see that these imply the global-global conjecture, which is this point here. So there's the instead of being L2 results, there's the Stricart's exponent, the restriction exponent, and that's just the scaling relation again, because R is infinity. And we'll also get an unconditional result. So in two dimensions, we improve this result of Thalmann-Vargas a little bit. So the Stricart's exponent is 15 is 3, so it's not far away. maybe quite far. And if you calculate what that is when Q is equal to 16, you see that this is 3/8. So in a sense, this is a globalized version of the result of Sanyugli. And if I get a chance to talk about it, we'll see that it's the same idea, just somehow. Right, so the proof, as I said earlier, is via bilinear arguments. And the kind of bilinear argument we're going to prove is this one. And important, so for a bilinear argument, you need separated frequency supports. This is the point. Might explain a bit more about that in a minute. And crucially here, normally, you just consider the frequency supports to be near the origin because of the Galilean invariance that I was talking about before. It doesn't matter how far you are from the origin, whereas it does matter now. So we need to keep track of this. We need to work far from the origin, and we need to get the correct exponent here. Because in order to pass from the bilinear to the linear arguments, we need the correct exponent there. So I'll just highlight this. Is not this theorem. I don't know. This argument will be by these pioneers of bilinear techniques. I'll just go over it quickly because it's slightly different and it's a nice argument. So how do you get the linear? To get a linear bound. So LQ, LR, if we square it, that is equal to LQ over 2, LR over 2, like that. Now, we just consider the frequency annulus, the annulus being near 1, then by Littlewood-Paley, you can get these HS bounds that I was telling you about. So you have your frequency support in an annulus, and we need this separation of frequency supports. So what we do is we break it up via Whitney decomposition into small cubes. We call them Q, J, K. and will consider functions FJK, Fourier supported, and these cubes. But via the Whitney decomposition, you only need to consider cubes which are near each other, not too near each other. So you have this separation. So by the triangle inequality, you have some sum. Don't worry too much about the details. So this, the J, this is the scale, 2 to the minus J. FJK, FJK prime. Now, I need frequency support separated by 1, so I scale it out by a factor of 2 to the J to get these frequencies separated by 1. I apply the theorem, and then I scale back in. And then via Whitney and so on, I can sum these pieces back up via orthogonality. So I end up with here, the scaling relationship pops out. Because I scale. I sum back up, I have a sum in this J in the scale. I can sum back up these cubes and I end up with F L2 squared here. And this pops out, because I've scaled far from the origin, this number comes in. And so I get 2 to the J, so everything's squared or so on, it's Q over 2 instead of Q. And I get 1 over Q minus 1 over R. And in order to complete the argument, in order to get the linear argument, the linear estimate, this sum needs to sum. And of course, and we see that this line pops up in here as well. I mean, the line that I told you about earlier is given by counterexamples. I mean, this, but also, you know, it pops up nicely in the argument as well. That in order for this sum to sum, we need to be the right side of the line. All right. So what I'll prove is this bilinear estimate. So this is slightly stronger than if there was an infinity there. But when you go from bilinear to linear, you can't get the square of this, but due to the summing, you can get it when in the correct place when this is equal to infinity. But this is what comes out in the argument. So this is what I'll prove, and that will give the linear estimate, and then by Littlewood-Paley up to n points. This is up to n points. This is what I told you I might be able to prove if Carlson's conjecture, or the Carlson problem, I don't know what to call that problem, if that were true, so we'd get this point. So to get this point, we need this bilinear estimate. So, an important part is localizing lemmas. So we're looking for estimates of this kind, and via a mixed norm epsilon removal argument due to Lee and Vargas, Sanyuk Lee and Anna Vargas, we can localize in time, and then you can localize further to a ball, but it's not so relevant here. And via another localizing lemma, we can localize to parallel pipeds or parallelotopes. I'm not sure what one should call them. So this is important because it's exactly the place where I'm at where one can work. So if you take a cube of side R and then you skew it. This is what I'm talking about. These PRs or this distance here is NR. Because as I told you before, if the frequency support is far from the origin, the waves move fast, so they have this shape. So we need that shape. So how do we, I'll prove this 5 implies 4, very quick here. Or the idea of the proof. It's actually quite a big calculation. But you use the wave packet decomposition, which I also want to talk about anyway, because it's one of the most important tools. So what you can do is you can break up the data so that the support, the Fourier support of FJK is contained in a ball of radius r to the minus 1/2. And that, of course, is contained in. So I'm always containing. By rotations, we only need to consider one point far from the origin. So this is on the x1 axis. So these Fourier supports, small Fourier supports, far from the origin. And the support of FJK is essentially contained in r to the half xk. And if you calculate, so there's a wave packet, a wave packet decomposition. If you calculate the solution, so by linearity you can pull out the sum. These little bits, these also called wave packets, the support of these for short time is contained in, essentially contained in, space-time such that x minus xk plus t, so tubes, like I was telling you before. And these psi j's are essentially the near n. So all these tubes, so I call these tj's, tjk's, all these tubes have got that kind of slope. So if I'm looking for a space-time estimate, up to R. Because I'm trying to prove this. I'm trying to say that I can only consider local pieces. Now, once I've, via the wave packet decomposition, I see that the solution is just a sum of lots of tubes. And the tubes, although they have different directions, they all have roughly that slope. So, and also I'll mention the frequencies, so the fact that F and G have separated Fourier supports, frequency supports, means that these tubes, two tubes with slightly different directions, never intersect like that. They intersect like that. And so that helps. Anyway, so how you can break up this space time via these parallel pipe bits or parallelotopes, which we call BLs. And we define the functions FL to be the sum of these tubes. If TJK intersect the parallel pipe bed, is non-empty, then we consider it. So, and we have, because these tubes essentially only intersect one parallel tope, you have orthogonality. You can recover the function via, by summing up. So, in order to get the space-time estimate, LQR, that we can we see that this roughly is less than or equal to, if we break it up into these parallel pipe beds, parallel topes, we only need to look at these functions, the ones which are intersecting roughly. And then if we have the bound, if we have this bound, then we get C in alpha R epsilon FL, we've got a sum in L. And then via Cauchy-Schwarz, we get what we want. And those, as I said before, we recover the estimate. So that's one important part. Now, so now we only need to consider these parallelotopes. We want to prove this with frequencies both far from the origin, separated, and yep, that's everything. The proof is via induction on scales, which is a really good idea. I think initially due to Bergan, who considered scales going from R to R square root R, and then by Wolf going from, so we consider the induction is on this R. So if you consider R large, then we're going to consider R to the power 1 minus delta. And that was Wolf who first did this. So induction passing from R to R to the 1 minus delta, or iteration. If we can improve that, so you get this bound for a bad alpha easily. So if you can improve that to this, obviously this is smaller. This, if delta is sufficiently small, is also smaller. So if you can prove it for general delta, small delta, then if you can make one step down to improve this bound, well, you can iterate it finitely to get to R to the power epsilon, and then you remove the epsilon via epsilon removal arguments, via the globalization lemmas. So that's the idea. Not mine. So how do you do it? You break up. So we were considering this piece, this parallel pipehead, and you divide it up. So you've got PR, and you divide it up into smaller ones. These have got side R to the 1 minus delta. And then you define a relation so that you can break up the function. Now I'm not going to tell you how to define the relation. It's very complicated. So that one part of the function is concentrated on the little p's. So this big one is PR, and the little ones are P. So you define a relation so that the function is concentrated on b, the one little b, and then not concentrated on the b. And then via by the induction hypothesis, because of this, the hard part, when f and g are concentrated on p, the little p, so there's a sum here, out here, of p's, you can deal with that just by induction. You get via this bound here, because r is now r to the 1 minus delta, you get a bound. So somehow the hard bit you deal with for free, the really hard bit. I'm not saying the rest of it's easy. And then you also have to deal with the easier bits. Now, so I'm brushing over, there's a sum here. So, if you've got this thing, f and g, that's less than or equal to, you end up with four bits. The hard bits, so the sum in b all over the p's, plus easier bits, g, and then two easy bits. So you have four bits. You deal with the first hard bit via induction, and then you use orthogonality arguments. These things, of course, are broken up into wave packets, as I was telling you before. And here, now you use this is the deep bit of the proof, orthogonality arguments due to Wolf and Tao, using the fact that one bit is supported away from this p, also using the fact that the tubes have different directions, you can get this bound, which is good bound. Then, how we get the result is, remember we're supposing the whole time that we have the Carlson conjecture. So this bound here comes from that. So that for 7 is implied via Cauchy-Schwarz from L2, L infinity. And I'll just put the global in here now. And 0 up to R. So now I just need this to be r to the 1 quarter, n to the half. Where the support of f hat is in b2 n e1. Such as Cauchy-Schwarz. And that is implied via scaling. Remember the scaling relationship. Nothing pops out, but I can scale this to get time supported between 0 and 1. Nothing pops out here because the scaling relation is 0. And now the support of f hat n r half 1. Because the scale, in the solution, you have this kind of, if you recall, we were talking about the paraboloid, and so if you scale in time, to get rid of an R here, you pay with an R to the half in the Fourier side. Because of this, because of the solution, the nature of the solution, you have this quadratic term. And then this is implied by the global bound that I was telling you that is equivalent to the Carlson conjecture. H one half. Because this is supported at nr to the half. So you take a half of that, you get what you wanted. So you can get this bound via the Carlson conjecture. You interpolate via Hilder, and it gives you what you want. And that's it. I'm not going to have time to tell you about this one. I didn't think I would do anyway. What's interesting is before we had this n term, positive n term, hurting us all the time. And this time we have a negative n term, which is what allows us to sum and gets us the extra. I've rubbed off the bilinear to linear argument, but this is very important to be able to get into this range where the S is negative. This is the strange range, if you like. So I won't tell you about that. Basically, that lemma becomes important where, so you have a supremum in this norm. You mix the norms even more. You mix them three times and you balance things out. That's just via Poincaré's theorem. And I'll stop there.